Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The mission of the Environmental Protection Agency is to protect human health and the environment. The man confirmed last month to lead the agency, former Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt, has spent the last 6 years repeatedly suing the EPA for its efforts to regulate mercury, smog, and other forms of pollution, and a trove of recently released emails have detailed close ties between Pruitt and fossil fuel interests. At the Conservative Political Action Conference last week, Scott Pruitt promised to respect the rights of states to set their own limits on environmental matters.
We're going to restore power back to the people. We're going to recognize that regulatory uncertainty and the regulatory state needs to be reined in. We're going to make sure that the states are recognized with the authority they have. And we're going to do the work that's important to advance freedom and liberty for the future.
Today, we're talking about the future of the EPA in the Trump era. Joining us by phone is Washington, D.C. correspondent for High Country News and former NPR environmental reporter Elizabeth Shogren. Welcome back.
Nice to be here.
So what is the regulatory mission of the EPA? How is that defined in the modern era?
Well, EPA's regulatory mission, of course, changes. It is set largely by Congress and by the statutes that Congress passes. And the agency and the administration redefine those goals based on what their priorities are. So some of the basics are cleaning the air, making it clean enough so that people can breathe healthy air and not get sick from the air quality. And EPA has made, in conjunction with the states, tremendous strides at improving air quality across the country. And cleaning the water. There was a time when the water in the United States was not fit for swimming or fishing. In many places, it's still not, but there's a great deal of progress that's been made through the years on cleaning up the water, especially from industrial waste, stopping people from pumping toxic chemicals straight into the waterways that people also use for drinking water and swimming, that kind of thing. And increasingly through recent administrations, the role of EPA for addressing climate change has grown. The Supreme Court has supported this role, and the Obama administration passed rules to reduce the climate change pollution that comes from cars and light trucks. And it also passed a rule called the Clean Power Plan that was intended to regulate coal-fired power plants and other sources of greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. That rule has been blocked now by the Supreme Court while they're considering, while the rule makes its way through the courts. And the new administration very specifically has said that they're not interested in that rule. They want to roll it back and some other initiatives of the Obama administration.
Now, that rule never went into effect. As you just said, the courts put the kibosh on it while it worked its way through the courts. So it's not like there are going to be jobs restored or jobs lost one way or the other. It has been in limbo so far anyway.
Well, that's a really good question. Will there be jobs restored or jobs lost? Of course, the utility industry is an incredibly conservative industry. They need to think far in advance and make their plans, because power plants can't just be built overnight. And so one of the ways that there will be an impact on which jobs are created and which ones are maintained is that when utility companies look into the future, they will have new information about what the future looks like, and that could impact the decisions they make about what kind of power to put in, what kind of power plants to put in place.
We're talking about the future of the EPA and a Trump administration. My guest right now, Elizabeth Shogren, Washington, D.C. correspondent for High Country News. It's been covering the EPA for many years, including for NPR. Scott Pruitt has suggested that the agency has overstepped its mission. Are there particular arms of the agency that concern him?
Well, yes. I mean, he has said that he wants to refocus the EPA on what states want, that that he thinks that the EPA has been making too many of its decisions based on what EPA wants and not what the Congress has specifically ordered EPA to do or what the states want. One of the best examples of this a rule known as either Waters of the United States or the Clean Water Rule. And what this is about is deciding which waterways and wetlands across America are protected by the federal government. That means the federal government gets a say when deciding whether or not somebody can, say, fill in a stream with a mountaintop for mountaintop mining or put in ditches instead of letting a free-flowing river go through their farmland. That's the kind of question that has been in dispute for decades. Congress was not specific when they wrote that part of the Clean Water Act, and so the courts have been fighting over this or people have been fighting over this in the courts for decades. And so the last administration tried to write a rule that would clearly state what waters are protected and what waters aren't. And one of the things that they decided is that very small streams are very important to the hydraulic system, and that those need to be protected, like the headwater streams that are in the top of mountains that are the places where they do mountaintop mining.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to fill in those streams, and this rule would say that those streams are protected by the Clean Water Act, and so there's been a lot of pushback on that rule from industry groups and states, because states want to be the ones to decide whether industry gets to fill in wetlands and waterways, or the state wants to protect them. It just wants to be the ones saying that.
And
31 states are in that lawsuit.
Okay.
And the Obama administration passed that rule. The courts stayed it, so it's not actually in effect right now. And President Trump said that he wants his agency to review it and greatly narrow the number of waters and wetlands that it considers federal domain. So instead of these little streams, it would just be what's called navigable waterways, like if you can put a boat in it, you know. And so and that's a more traditional understanding what the reach of the Clean Water Act is. And Administrator Pruitt has said that he will rescind the Clean Water Rule, and he will it's going to be a long process. It can't be done overnight, but as I said, it stayed in the courts anyway. So so what we'll see over time is what the administration's new policy is specifically.
More than 6,000 emails were made public last week showing Scott Pruitt's relationships with the fossil fuel industry and what appears to be potential conflicts of interest. What did those emails show? I mean, did he do anything illegal that's becoming apparent from them?
Well, I did review many of the emails and did a story about them, and I asked a lot of experts who were reviewing the emails, and as far as they knew, there wasn't any illegal activity. The question is, what kind of an administrator are we getting? You know, there's this man who's going to be the head of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. He is the head of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, and what are his priorities? How does he do his job? And I think the emails were very interesting because they gave us insight into just how closely he worked with industry when he was the Attorney General of Oklahoma. And an example that I focused on was the Bureau of Land had to do with a Bureau of Land Management rule, which had to do with regulating the pollution, the methane pollution, the air pollution that comes from drilling oil and gas.
Mm-hmm.
And this the Bureau of Land Management manages federal lands in the West. It's the manager for oil and gas that's drilled on public lands, and so national forests and other public lands, including those managed by the Bureau of Land Management. And so this rule would basically step in and put some requirements on how methane is methane leaks are fixed, so mm-hmm. that it doesn't. That's the company's product. It can be wasted by just leaking into the air, and also there are harmful emissions that come out of it that contribute to things like haze and ozone pollution and health problems in the public. So anyway, they were and back to the Pruitt emails, that the emails show how a company, Devon Energy, was drafting letters for Pruitt to send to the White House and coaching Pruitt to make meetings with the Obama White House in order to stand up against this rule. And, you know, it's fascinating to see how this worked, and the letters eventually did get sent to the White House, and the meetings eventually happened. And Pruitt also, his office played this key role in getting other attorneys general from around the United States to sign on to the letters and to oppose this rule and tell the White House, don't go forward. Now, that's not illegal, but it shows how Pruitt really was working to, in concert with the oil and gas industry to do what they wanted to have done.
He has remarked in the past that the role of humans in causing global warming is uncertain at best. In his confirmation hearings, he walked some of that back. Do we know whether the new EPA head believes in climate change and the role of humans in climate change?
Well, the part of the story that's very, he hedges a lot about the role that humans play in climate change and whether that is provable. And one thing that's important to know is that there is strong scientific consensus. That means the science is agreed upon by the vast majority of scientists across the country that humans are causing climate change. It's not a question. There is so much. What we're doing is we're forcing so much carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions into our atmosphere that it's that they have those levels have spiked upward because of all of our industrial uses like power plants and cars and everything else. Mm-hmm. And the result of that is that our climate has already changed and it threatens to change much more in the future. And so the question is, what then do you do about it? And the Obama administration had a very strong policy to try to curtail our emissions and work with the world to curtail the global emissions. And what seems to be coming out of the current administration is that they don't have that same priority.
According to different reports have come out just in the last few days that the Trump administration is expected to reduce the EPA staff by 20%. What's the stomach in Congress for doing this to an agency the likes of EPA, which, by the way, was created during the Nixon administration?
Right. I mean, you're going to see a huge battle over this. It's important to remind people that the Trump administration doesn't have the final say over this. Congress passes its, Congress gets a say on this, and then they negotiate, and it's going to be a long, drawn-out process.
Mm-hmm.
But the kinds of cuts that Trump's White House is considering would be very drastic, and it would be those cuts would come in in the grants that EPA gives to states and how states watch out for air quality and water quality and clean up toxic wastes and how a whole array of programs that EPA does. The other cuts that will come in how EPA enforces its rules. Mm-hmm. If some industry is flouting EPA's rules and is illegally polluting environments with toxic waste, EPA can come in and do investigations and crack down. Or if it finds that a whole industry is ignoring the law, it can crack down in those kinds of ways, and it does. And what these changes would do would be to significantly hamstring EPA's ability to do that. And whether Congress will put up with it or not, we will have to see. I think we've never really had a situation quite like this. There have been Republican Congresses that have tried to do something like this. Gingrich's Congress tried to do this, but President Bill Clinton was in office right then, and he pushed back, and he didn't let that happen. So this is different because we have Republicans in control of both houses of Congress, and we have a Republican president, and, you know, so all bets are off.
Elizabeth Shogren, thanks again for joining us. I always appreciate your insights.
Thank you for your time.
Elizabeth Shogren is Washington, D.C. correspondent for High Country News and former NPR environmental reporter. We continue our conversation about the future of the EPA during the Trump administration. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In his previous role as Oklahoma's Attorney General, Scott Pruitt fought the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency at every corner, suing the agency a total of 12 times to block its efforts to regulate mercury pollution, smog, carbon emissions, and more. Now he leads the EPA and already has promised to aggressively roll back regulations put in place by the Obama administration. The question now is what direction environmental protection policies will take during the Trump era. Coming up, we'll hear from the Heritage Foundation on environmental reforms and how they see it. Joining us now is Executive Director of the Ohio Environmental Council, Heather Taylor Measley. Welcome back.
Hi, great to be here.
And by phone, President and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, Colin O'Mara. Welcome to the show, Colin.
Thanks for having me on.
Colin, the bipartisan National Wildlife Federation, for the first time in its 80-year history, opposed a nominee to lead the U.S. EPA. What was the tipping point when it came to Scott Pruitt?
I mean, we have a pretty basic three-part test that isn't, I don't think, even a particularly high bar, but the three-point test is that we want someone that supports sound science, wants somebody that kind of believes and is willing to uphold the integrity of the governing statutes, the bedrock laws, in this case the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and RCRA and others. And then we also want someone that has no conflicts that we've seen kind of early in their career that prevent them from kind of putting the interests of the American people above special interests. And in this particular case, because of Mr. Pruitt's questioning of whether mercury is bad for kids, his kind of constant kind of questioning of climate science, his assault on clean air rules, mercury rules, cross-state air pollution rules, climate rules, water rules, and then also the relationship we had with industry, we felt for the first time in our 80-year history that we had to oppose a nominee, which was a big decision, but one I still think was the right one.
Former EPA Director Gina McCarthy, she served from 2013 through the end of the Obama administration. She said that the proposed budget for the EPA ignores the need to invest in science and to implement law. Is Pruitt suggesting that the EPA cease scientific investigation? Because when I look at the broad brushstrokes that I've seen so far of the proposed cuts, and we've acknowledged they need to go through Congress yet, so much of it has to do with research and data gathering.
Yeah, I mean, I think the I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding within the administration about kind of the function that EPA plays and the support they provide to states, the research that is done on both trying to solve existing problems as well as confront future problems. And this is actually the budget that came out of the budget office. This isn't EPA was kind of handed this budget, and they're asked to give their comments. No one in this country voted for dirtier air and dirtier water and Superfund sites not being cleaned up and brownfields being left to keep leaching pollution into the groundwater tables. But I think there is. I mean, these cuts are draconian in a way we've never seen before. And frankly, you're seeing Republicans pretty much across the too deep. Guys like Congressman Mike Simpson from Idaho saying, you know, there's no way we're going to, you know, go along with something that's so deep when so much of the assistance is frankly directly to the states for things like clean water, for things like cleaning up sites. I just think they've overreached dramatically and vastly underestimated the American people's desire for clean air and clean water and healthy soils.
Heather Taylor-Measley, from where you sit as executive director of the Ohio Environmental Council, how much does Ohio turn to the EPA for guidance on things? In other words, how much of research is being done at the federal level that Ohio uses in its own work?
Well, I think that Ohio has a fairly great EPA administrator here in the state who's been working very hard to address things like lead and water and doing some other good things. You know, we always want them to do more. But I do think that we do depend on the federal EPA to do some really important basic things like the science. And then, you know, one of the things that's happening with this budget, Pruitt would like to delegate all of these to give states more power.
Right.
But at the same time, they're saying, well, we're going to cut your money to do that. And so really what they're doing is they're placing a heavy burden on our state agencies to try to figure out how to deal with massive amounts of pollution, with brownfields, with our Keeping Up with the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and climate change. And then they're saying we're going to give you less to actually implement that, which is really, really serious. And that's not only on the financial side. They're also doing it on the staff side. We're talking anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 people that would be cut out of the federal agency. And those are folks who give guidance to our state legislators, our state decision makers, our state administrators, and the local level as well. And so it's a really big crisis. And I'm really hoping that somebody actually learns the mission of the agency up there and takes a step back.
Ohio has a relatively strong EPA, state EPA, but there's lots of states that don't. Right, Colin Amara?
Yeah, so I was actually the Secretary of Natural Resources for the state of Delaware for 5.5 years. So I've worked with Scott Nally and Craig Butler and, you know, the great team that you've had there. And I think, you know, I think that Ohio has had, you know, kind of greater involvement in some issues. You know, obviously, we always want people to do more, as Heather said, and we work closely with Heather's team all the time. But, you know, there's cross-state issues, right, that like, for example, like using my home state of Delaware, like 95% of the air pollution coming into the state is coming from out-of-state sources. Like, we can't have healthy air in Delaware unless states up west of us, to the west of us, clean up their power plants and other sources of emissions. And so, like, in those kind of issues, you need a federal government. I mean, the thing that kills me is that the whole reason that, you know, the President Nixon signed the EPA and did the executive order to kind of create the EPA with Bill Ruckelshaus in the 70s was because, you know, we had massive issues, right, starting in Ohio and other places, both on the air side and on the water side, because states alone didn't have the tools to address these issues. And there's a perverse kind of disincentive from trying to address your pollution kind of too aggressively, which could be seen as an economic disincentive, and if another state is going to allow much greater levels of pollution. So even though I'm a firm believer that you can have a healthy environment and a strong economy at the same time, you need to have a level playing field. And as you're saying, I mean, there are states that are just very weak on this side because of the role of industry or the role of state law. And so you want that kind of common denominator, kind of lifting all, kind of use too many metaphors, but trying to lift all boats to have kind of basic air and water quality across all states, and then also dealing with these regional issues at the same time.
Heather, have officials in Ohio responded to what's coming out of the EPA at this point?
It sounds like they're still trying to figure out what's real and what's not real, honestly. And I think that they're pretty pragmatic on a lot of these issues. So I think that they'll probably end up trying to deal with things as they come. But I think Colin hits the nail on the head, though. You know, what our regulators do here in the state is one thing. It's really important, and we're certainly thankful to have some folks that we can talk to continue to improve the environment here in the state. But this is really a national effort. We all have to think together about how to address some of these really, really big problems. The water doesn't stop. And the Ohio River, for instance, covers a number of states. It's one of the largest rivers in the entire country. And so just addressing some of the pollution in Ohio really does little for the health of the river overall. These are solutions that have to come together, and we need the federal EPA to be strong to help lead a productive conversation.
We're talking about the future of the EPA under the Trump administration. You just heard from Heather Taylor-Measley. She's executive director of the Ohio Environmental Council, and also with me by phone, Colin O'Mara. He's president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. A Greenpeace spokesman I read said that the proposed cutbacks would disproportionately affect poor Americans and minorities. He called it environmental racism in action. What's he getting at, Colin? What's going on?
Well, some of the biggest challenges we face as a nation right now relate to issues in urban areas. And so if you look at rates of asthma, if you look at rates of lead poisoning, you look at rates of other types of respiratory or cardiac disease, they do tend to be disproportionately in lower-income communities and in urban populations. And one of the things that I think I was on the other side of the lawsuits with against Attorney General Ben Pruitt on some of the mercury rules and trying to reduce the the goal was to reduce the amount of mercury in the air. It's a neurotoxin that can forever impair a child's development. And Scott Pruitt was on the side suing against that rule, trying to stop it. If you start walking back these protections, they tend to be communities that don't have other tools at their disposal to protect themselves. And I don't want to sound paternalistic in the way that that may have been framed, but a lot of the environmental justice issues in our country. I mean, for example, I'll use Lake Erie as an example. You know, when the water system gets polluted by microcystin because you have the massive algal bloom that overtook the water intake for Toledo. I mean, the pollution sources were coming from, a broad range of sources. I mean, up the Maumee, up from Detroit, mm-hmm. a big issue. But the folks that were impacted, the 400,000 residents of Toledo, a big chunk of which are low income, that frankly didn't really contribute to the problem in the first place. And so, we saw the same thing in Flint, right, where like government decisions, kind of bad decisions over years, lack of investment, lack of transparency leads to kind of, kids being poisoned and they're from toxic lead-filled water. And so, we've seen this over and over again. So I think the language is maybe a little over the top, but I think that the point they're making about low-income kids suffering the brunt of environmental pollution is spot on.
The other thing that they're doing is zeroing out a number of programs that would be very supportive of these types of communities and getting them involved. So, for instance, the Environmental Justice Office in this budget is proposed to be completely zeroed out. And so that's a program that goes in and supports communities to try to get their voice out, to make sure that we're listening well. Another one that they're trying to get rid of is the brownfields program. So we're going to zero that out. And here in Ohio, that doesn't just mean that people are going to be sicker or living in worse communities. That also means jobs to clean up these sites that may have been abandoned or sites that are former industrial entities in some way. To clean those
so
up,
that
it takes
you can
a
build
person.
Different
yeah.
factories or different businesses.
Or green space, parks, yeah. any of those things. But, right now we're not only putting in laws in place that will make people less healthy, we're giving them fewer tools to actually participate in the process, which is a serious issue.
The Trump administration has delayed indefinitely a plan to prevent Asian carp from reaching the Great Lakes, where scientists said they could cause severe harm to native fish populations. That, of course, affects Ohio and Lake Erie and the walleye. Right. I mean, Heather Taylor Measley, what's happening right now with this? I know it affects Chicago and Illinois more directly at this point because the source is out of Lake Michigan, but what does this mean?
Yeah, Asian carp is not just an environmental issue. This is another economic issue, right? People fish in Lake Erie, a huge central part of our industry up there is all based around the lake, whether that's tourism or whether that's some kind of horticulture. There's just a lot of things going on. If Asian carp start to really penetrate Lake Erie, all of those things will be jeopardized. And I know that this is an issue that sometimes people, it's kind of one of those that just seems like a sidebar issue, but it could be very, very fundamental. If you add the Asian carp invasion with toxic algae
to zebra mussels,
all of these things, it puts the health of Lake Erie not just on the environmental front, but on the economic front at risk, and that would be bad, bad news for Ohio and all the people who live in that area.
Yeah, Colin Amaro, I've heard Debbie Stabenow from Ohio, congressman from Ohio.
I'm sorry, from Michigan. From Michigan, thank you. From Michigan, protest this. Lake Michigan, you know, Michigan obviously is surrounded by the Great Lakes and is much more impacted by it. But what are other states saying? There are a lot of other entities, including Canada, for that matter, that are concerned about the Asian carp.
Yeah, I mean, I think what the thing that's frustrating about this issue is that I'm not funny. There's not like a pro Asian carp lobby.
Exactly.
There's not like there's some group, you know, I mean. They taste okay, but that's about it. It affects, and Heather hit it exactly right. Hurts the economy, hurts tourism. I mean, and what worries me is that these are bipartisan values. And I'll use the Healing Our Waters Coalition, the Great Lakes kind of restoration initiative coalition of groups that come together that I think Heather, you guys are in the middle of.
Mm-hmm.
There's this amazing bipartisan, nonpartisan coalition that helps ensure, you know, dedicated funding for non-regulatory primarily funding initiatives for the Great Lakes. It's got this commerce, it's got the mayors, it's got the governors, it's got the environmental and the conservation and the sportsman groups. I mean, everyone comes together because of all the regions of the country, there is no place that values its water more than the Great Lakes. And so to have these kind of, again, I mean, I think the Asian carp example got caught up in this broader swath. We're going to stop everything. We're going to take a look at everything. Then we're going to try to restart. But there has to be some level of common sense, right? Because, I mean, who knows? I mean, there are already, you know, Asian carp kind of coming up, you know, kind of through the system. We know that.
Right.
You know, there's all the work in Minnesota and other places trying to, you know, kind of cut some of the kind of the vectors, the pathways. But, you know, we have to be, and this is the kind of stuff where, like, there should have been someone that said, hey, look, that's not really regulatory at all. Like, let's just keep going. And there isn't that kind of common sense filter, as I'm seeing it, they're trying to sift out, you know, kind of the full largesse of, you know, the entire kind of federal estate.
We are going to continue our conversation. I have to say goodbye to Heather Taylor Measley, Executive Director of the Ohio Environmental Council. Thanks for joining us, Heather.
Anytime.
And coming up, we're going to hear from the Research Fellow at the Center for Free Markets and Regulatory Reform at the Heritage Foundation to get their take on this, the future of the EPA in a Trump administration. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The new chief of the Environmental Protection Agency has been on the job for about 2 weeks and has started to roll back regulations already established under the Obama administration. We're talking about the future of the EPA under the Trump administration today. Still with us is President and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, Colin O'Mara. Colin, thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Joining us by phone now is Research Fellow at the Center for Free Markets and Regulatory Reform at the Heritage Foundation, Darren Baxt. Welcome to the show, Darren.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here.
Darren, you've written, and I'm quoting now, that the EPA and many of its regulations are ripe for reform. So you support the spirit of change at the EPA. Are you comfortable with the speed with which the change is being dispatched at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the agency has to kind of address some of these overreaching rules, such as the Waters in the United States rule. And my expectation would be that they would move relatively quickly, because quite simply, even when you get rid of a rule like the Waters of the United States rule, you still have to provide some clarity to people, to property owners that are regulated, to know what the regulations are going to say. So you still have to know what the law is going to be. So they're going to presumably get rid of the rule, but then come up with some clarification on what the meaning of the statute is. So you need to move quickly on it for regulatory predictability and also to protect the environment.
Right. Let's talk about the Asian carp issue that's popped up. It's certainly a big issue in the Great Lakes region. No one seems to be against working to stem the spread of the Asian carp in the Great Lakes, but they've gone ahead and indefinitely suspended that work. What's the benefit of that? Who's against that?
Honestly, I was listening to what you were talking about before. I can't say that I'm an Asian carp expert.
Well,
I will,
me either.
I will say that one of the bigger themes that you're going to see with the EPA, I would hope, is kind of this respect for cooperative federalism, where the federal government works with the states and local communities to address various issues. There's no question, I think, that local communities in the states have kind of more interest in issues like the Asian carp or any other kind of issue on the local level, and they're going to care more, they're going to have better solutions to their particular problems. So I think the bigger question is it really necessary for the federal government to be providing all the solutions, or should we start looking to states and local governments to do that?
Do you feel confident that all the states are as well equipped as, are they all equally well equipped to take on this burden that also comes with a lot of strategic cuts and grants and that sort of thing?
Well, I can't imagine all states are equal in any way. I don't think anything that would be possible, anybody or any entity.
Yeah.
But I think the states are up for the task. Congress, when they passed the Clean Water Act, certainly envisioned that states would take a leading role when it comes to water, and also for kind of a cooperative federalism when it comes to the Clean Air Act as well. So certainly states are supposed to take a leading role. The existing laws are kind of outdated, and the EPA has a role to play, but really what they should be doing is making sure there's no backsliding, so the states are not kind of not meeting the standards that exist, and addressing things that might be more interstate in nature. And then allow the states and local communities to be innovative, come up with new solutions to address some of these very kind of clear environmental problems, and look to outcomes and making sure we have successful outcomes as opposed to trying to dictate how to achieve certain results.
But you're interested in evidence-based solutions, right?
Sure. And what I believe is that as you see the states and local communities develop solutions across the country for all kinds of different environmental problems, you'll see other states and local communities start to mirror what they're doing because you'll have new best practices to address those challenges. It's kind of difficult if the federal government is creating kind of a one-size-fits-all approach, because quite honestly, one size does not fit all.
How does a state, we were talking earlier, Colin O'Mara, I think, mentioned it, that a state like Delaware, a small state that doesn't create a lot of the pollution but suffers from the after effects of pollution, whether it's water pollution or air pollution especially, what role do they play when they're not creating it in the first place?
Well, it's not going to be federal standards. I mean, there are. Plus, the states do have kind of their own environmental issues themselves in their own environmental bodies to address it. And as I was saying, issues that do kind of involve more of like the cross-state, like interstate air issues or mm-hmm. water issues, might be something where there is more of a role for the federal government.
Okay.
Or it can very well can be addressed through regional compacts and across the states themselves.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking right now with Darren Baxt. He's a research fellow at the Center for Free Markets and Regulatory Reform at the Heritage Foundation. Colin O'Mara, president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, is also with us. Colin, what about the development of the EPA? What was envisioned, from what you understand about it, when it came to states' participation and what states' roles were going to be in the implementation of federal laws?
Yeah, I think our colleague actually laid it out well. I mean, the goal was this good model of cooperative federalism where the feds would help set standards. The states would be kind of charged with implementing them. There'd be accountability on the federal side to make sure the standards were being met. And at the same time that the EPA would be leading the way on making sure that the standards are science-based, making sure that they're kind of grounded in the best data and the best science that was available. And then also EPA would step in on these regional issues. And so you see, now, there's a lot of language in different statutes around the role of EPA to deal with multi-jurisdictional issues. And so I don't actually disagree philosophically with a lot of things that have said in this segment. I think where I struggle, though, is that there's still an important role. I feel like these pendulums swing really, really far, where some administrations are incredibly focused on kind of having a federal solution to everything. Other administrations focus on state solutions to everything. And the model is, frankly, much more nuanced than that, where you have this balance. And I think I'm worried that we're swinging too far to kind of just a state-side solution. As a former state regulator, you know, I didn't like how aggressive, you know, some things were on the federal side. And at the same time, If the states can't do it alone, and I had given the example earlier about Delaware on air pollution, but there's examples on water pollution where state contacts, frankly, are insufficient because it's never in the greater kind of the polluter state's interest to reduce their pollution if they think there's an economic disadvantage. And so you do have to have, you know, a federal regime to be able to deal with those situations. But I'm just hoping we get to more balance. And I feel like we went from one extreme on the left to now another extreme on the right, and there has to be a happy medium somewhere between them.
Right. I mean, wouldn't everybody agree, Darren Baxt, that whether it's a company, local governments, any kind of interested party needs more time to study the issues and it needs more guidance long term?
I'm not sure what issue we'd be talking about, but I mean, I think one of the problems that has existed is that the EPA has look, the statutes themselves, environmental statutes, first of all, the EPA wasn't even created by statute. It was actually created by President Nixon in kind of a, I don't know if it's an executive order, but kind of a presidential document of some kind. But so that's another story. But the environmental statutes, as we've discussed, do have this kind of cooperative federalism approach. And unfortunately, for a number of years, the EPA has simply interpreted those statutes and continued to try to expand its power, and there is a pushback now, absolutely, to try to respect the rule of law and also the state role that was supposed to exist in the first place in these statutes. And it used to exist, but it's not nearly, doesn't exist like it did before. And I think the WOTUS rule, the Waters of the United States rule, really is one of the great examples of where it was just a complete really ignoring the states and also local governments. It's not simply the farmers and the ranchers that are concerned about that rule. It's local, you know, it's the counties, cities, states as well. And it's just kind of this feeling that there's this trampling on the state rights and for that matter, property owners' rights.
Is this the rule that addresses what size waterways will be regulated?
Well, it's what types of waters will be regulated.
Okay.
So, you know, it's in the statute, the Clean Water Act is supposed to cover navigable waters, but the way it's been interpreted for a number of years by the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers has been, it certainly has gone away from the concept of anything being navigable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been extremely overbroad. And the problem also is that if you're a regulated party, and many people are going to be regulated in this situation, is the law is so subjective and vague, it's very hard to even know how to comply with it. And the truth is, if by developing a more clear rule, a more bright line rules, it will help the EPA actually in enforcement because it'll provide clarity for them, and it'll also improve compliance. And I think all of this helps to helps the environment. And one other point I'd like to point out is I don't think that there's this kind of the states look at improving the environment as some type of being harmful to their economy. I'm not sure if that was the point or this kind of race to the bottom argument that exists. I think states recognize the value that the environment has and the appeal that it has to try to bring people into their states and also for the residents in the states.
You've said that the EPA's regulatory decisions shouldn't be foregone conclusions. Isn't that kind of what the Trump administration is doing in sweeping away the regulations established during the Obama administration? Shouldn't the EPA evaluate those regulations before eliminating them?
Well, I think that they're going to have to. I think, like with the executive order on WOTUS, for example, that was mentioned. Look, it's not like people haven't studied it and know all the significant problems that exist. It's not necessarily it's not a scientific question that goes into what should be covered. There's also the concept of the respective rule of law and property rights as well. You can have an opinion on it right now without having to necessarily go into a very in-depth analysis to figure out what ultimately needs to be the what the rule should look like. But there's a lot of details that still have to be resolved, and the executive order certainly recognized that it didn't get that prescriptive. It said that the agencies need to review and possibly rescind and possibly and maybe come up with a new rule.
Uh-huh.
And also then look to, it doesn't say that it has to be consistent with the Justice Scalia plurality opinion in the Rapanos case. in terms of defining what waters are covered under the law,
right.
But that they should look at that. It doesn't say definitively to do it. It just says they should take a look at that, which is something that EPA simply did not do in developing the WOTUS rule.
Now, the Office of Management and Budget, or Budget and Management at the federal level, has put forth a proposed budget. It didn't come out of the EPA itself, but it looks to eliminate about one out of every five jobs in the EPA as a budget cutting in a budget cutting effort. How do they do all of this revision? How do they do all of this reconsidering of regulations with a fifth of its workforce? Darren Baxter, are you concerned about that?
Well, I think we need to see some of the details on what they're actually going to be proposing. I imagine there's going to be a decent amount of cutting of certain programs that, quite honestly, probably shouldn't exist. So that would be one way of doing it. I also think by providing some clarity in with regulations and setting priorities a lot better than the EPA has done, you can also save money in that way and also be able to cut staff. So I'd like to see what they're actually recommending in terms mm-hmm. of changes within the programs and the policies. And then from there, we can see whether or not it's reasonable to assume that you can cut the staff at that level. My guess is there's plenty of programs that can be cut and still be able to kind of meet the mission of the EPA.
Colin Amaro?
I mean, I think, I don't know, I mean, I'd like to maybe get back to the clean water rule just for a second. I mean, I think that the challenge that we're seeing is that, like, just because people don't like some of the kind of the tools that are recommended through some of these regulations doesn't mean that they aren't grounded in the law. And we've seen the Supreme Court say repeatedly that they need the agency to make it very clear kind of what's in bounds within the rule and what's not. And it is based on science. I mean, I think I would like to see better kinds of solutions. The challenge that I see, and this links to the question about the budget, a lot of the innovation that is possible to clean up water are some of the very programs that are being proposed for cutting right now. You want more collaboration. You want more kind of private, public-private partnership solutions. You want more kind of creative things. Like, let's invest in science. Let's invest in research and technology. Let's invest in innovation. And those are the very first things around the chopping block. And so I think I would love to see non-regulatory solutions to a lot of these problems. Or they take investment. You can't both deregulate and divest at the same and disinvest at the same time. Like you need to be finding ways to get more pollution out of these water columns. A lot of it's going to be upstream and wetlands and places like that. If you want clean water, for example. But it's hard at the same time as you're basically saying, look, we're not going to have these rules, and at the same time, we're not going to fund the very things that could achieve the outcome through other means. The only outcome at that point is dirtier air and dirtier water. I mean, and that's the sad part, because a lot of the states are struggling on their own state budget size, as you guys are in Ohio, that it's not like the state can come up with an extra couple hundred million dollars to put into some of these efforts right now to make up for the shortfalls. And I think that's where the ideological arguments are falling apart, because the outcomes are what's going to suffer at the end of the day.
Darren Baxter, the EPA, you said the EPA shouldn't act unethically or break the law to promote its agenda. I'm wondering if you're concerned about the distraction regarding the potential ethics issues on the other side of the coin, given the disclosure last month of those 6,000 emails between Scott Pruitt and special interest groups in Oklahoma.
Look, no, I'm not focused on that. When I was writing about the issue, I was writing about what the actions of the EPA were in trying to promote the WOTUS rule, and it was inappropriate for the EPA to basically be acting as an activist group, which is what they were doing, and what the Government Accountability Office actually determined they were doing, acting improperly and in fact, acting in a lobbying type of manner. So I'm looking at what the government agency itself is doing, and I don't think that should be really controversial to believe that the agency shouldn't act unethically. I also would point out, just on we're talking about the water stuff and the legal issues and about the EPA kind of working within the law. The truth is the EPA and the Corps, when it comes to these water issues, keep getting shot down by the U.S. Supreme Court in terms of their overreach in what they're trying to regulate when it comes to the waters. It's very rare for the Supreme Court to basically disagree with an agency interpretation what they can do, and the Supreme Court shot them down twice in the last 10 to 15 years.
Darren Baxter, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your
time.
Thank you. Darren Baxter, Research Fellow at the Center for Free Markets and Regulatory Reform at the Heritage Foundation. Also, Colin O'Mara, President and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
I want to remind folks they can join me and WOSU-TV's Mike Thompson for Politics and a Pint. It is tonight at Seventh Sun Brewing from 5:30 to 7:30. We hope to have a lively conversation. Plus, you'll see a special taping of WOSU-TV's Columbus on the Record. That's it for All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.